you know, Joseph Campbell did a whole program, a whole series of, I don't know, did you ever meet him
before? Yeah, a little bit. I loved him.
Yeah. On pursuing, you know, Joseph Campbell did a whole program, a whole series of, I don't know, did you ever meet him before?
Yeah, a little bit. I loved him.
Yeah. On pursuing your bliss. I've often felt as I talk to salespeople and business people around the world that so many of them are looking to set goals and to find out the way to make money and to get the things that they want for themselves. And I always think about bliss as what you have to do first is fall in love with what you do. And then what you sell is that love. You don't sell what you do, you don't sell your product, you transform yourself as someone who's out there giving away bliss. And many of you have heard me talk over the years about the orange. When you squeeze an orange, what comes out is orange juice, because that's what's inside. And the same metaphor expands. It doesn't matter what time of day you squeeze it, it doesn't matter what instrument you use, it doesn't matter what the circumstances are. When you squeeze an orange, you get what's inside. Well, when someone squeezes you, and out of you comes anger or frustration or bitterness or non-bliss, it really isn't because of who did the squeezing. As much as we like to convince ourselves that that's what's causing us to have non-bliss, it's because that's what's inside. And how that gets inside, I use the thing as if this were my car key, and I'm in my house, and I were to, and it's dark in the house, and I were to drop my key, and I look around for a while, and I say, well, I'm not going to look in here. It's dark. But I notice that outside, there's a street light. So I go out under the street light, and I'm out here, and I'm looking for my key. And a friend of mine comes along and says, Wayne, what happened? I said, well, I dropped my key, and I can't find it. And he said, well, I'll help you find it. And we look for a half an hour, and finally he says to me, well, where did you drop it? I said, well, I dropped it in the house, but there's no light in there, so I came out here to look under. He said, well, you mean to tell me you dropped your key in there, but you're looking for it out here? I said, well, yeah, because the light is here. Now, that makes as much sense, but isn't that what we do when we have a problem that is in here and we look for the solution out there? When we're looking for the answer in a place, the answer has to be where the problem is. And if bliss is in here because of the way you have chosen, is that how you chosen to process the world? Then that's all you'll have to give away. And when the stuff, the negative stuff, comes into your life, as it will, at least I found that it will. I mean, it's hills and valleys. It's about getting annihilated. And then thinking that you got it made, and then another annihilation comes along, and how you deal with that and how you grow from that. But if you believe that your inner world is the result of what other people are saying or doing, what I think you have to do is develop an inner candle flame. You know, that never flickers, though the worst goes before you. I don't pretend to be able to do that at all times, but I'm a lot better at it than I used to be.
Yeah, and the thing to remember is it's okay to have all the negativity. It's okay to feel angry, and it's okay to feel negative, but to realize that that's part of a spectrum, and that there is other part of the scenery. They're both there, and we reconcile ourselves to their coexistence. That's the important thing. And the universe is always sending out two messages, always. You don't have to really even be intellectual about this. There's one message that is inside the body. It's a message of comfort. And there's another message inside the body that's one of discomfort. These are the only two messages we get. And you don't have to be intellectual, as I said. Just tune into your physical body. Spirituality is an extremely sensual experience. And there's another, this is a different idea than most people have. They separate the senses from and sensuality from spirituality, from consciousness. But if the body is the product of that consciousness, then to be grounded in the body, in your own sensuality even, is to be grounded in the presence of God. And to therefore structure your behavior in such a way that it amplifies the bliss, as Campbell said, follow the bliss, amplify the signal of comfort in your physical body, and do things that do not give you the experience of discomfort in your physical body, and you're on the path to spirituality.
When you were talking this morning, you mentioned not only is it stranger than we think, it's stranger than we can think, and that it's a thinking universe. In fact, you mentioned the other day that someday you'd like to write something like that, that it's a thinking universe. One thing that you did with me one time was to talk about the thinking body, that most of us really and truly do think that our thinking takes place in the brain, and that's all, and that's where thought originates, and that somehow that is, and that the rest of the body doesn't think. But let's use an example, like right now, as a matter of fact, it's under the lights and everything, and I'm thirsty, okay? What's going on in my body? I mean, to prove that the body is thinking all over the place.
So as soon as you have that idea, I am thirsty, then your brain, your cortex, it makes a peptide, a protein called angiotensin II. And that angiotensin II, it influences your behavior in such a way that you start looking for water.
Which is what I'm going to do while you're talking.
You start looking for water. At the same time, there's another part of your brain called the hypothalamus, and that also secretes angiotensin II. That makes the hypothalamus secrete a hormone called ADH, antidiuretic hormone, that makes your body hold on to water. At the same time, your kidneys make angiotensin II, so you don't lose it in the urine, you hold on to it. At the same time, your skin cells make angiotensin II, so you don't sweat as much, you hold on to the water in the skin. Your lungs make it, so the lungs start saying to themselves, I need water. You don't lose water in the breath. Your heart cells make it. In other words, as soon as you had the idea, I want water, it was simultaneously everywhere in all the cells of your body at the same time. It didn't first occur here in English or Swahili. It occurred everywhere at the same time. So it was omnipresent. And the scientific term for this is thinking, therefore, is a non-local phenomenon. Even though we think it's local, it's localized to the brain, it's not. Because the mind isn't in the brain. The mind is expressing itself as the body, which is a space-time event everywhere, all at the same time. In other words, every thought is omniscient, it's omnipresent, it's omnipotent. Now, where was that thought, I am thirsty or I want water, before you had it? Where was it? It was a probability amplitude in the gap. And where was it before that? Everywhere and nowhere at the same time. Just a pure field potentiality. Then when that field began to interact, it became a probability amplitude, which is the wave. And in the frozen moment of attention, it became the particle, which is the material form. But the material form, which is that which ultimately expresses itself as material reality, the wave and the field are all the same thing. They're just some different manifestations.
So that every part of my body is thinking all the time?
All the time.
Now, let's say I'm feeling tense and I need a Valium. Can my body... I'm feeling tense and I want to have a Valium, or I want to have some kind of tranquilizer or whatever. Can my body, am I capable, if I learn how to get to this higher place, which we're going to get to, and manufacture that for myself without having to go to the drugstore?
At a deep level of awareness, if you have this notion, and it's a notion, it's just a notion, it's just an idea, that I'm having the experience of tranquility, then your body will indeed make Valium. The only thing is, it won't make it in such doses that you'll feel like a zombie. Mm. It'll make it in the precise dose that's necessary to allow your cells to do the job in tranquility. When you're feeling jittery, then your body will make jittery molecules like adrenaline, and it won't make it just from the adrenal gland, it makes little platelets will make adrenaline. These are frightened platelets that are huddling together because they're scared. Mm. If you're feeling...
But that's true, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, that truly
that's
is going on.
That's how the clotting cascade starts. And if you're feeling exhilarated, then as I said earlier, you're making interleukins and interferons, which are very powerful anti-cancer drugs. Now, I go on a joyride, let's say on Magic Mountain, and I make interleukins, but somebody else goes and they don't. They make adrenaline. It's not the joyride. Mm. It's my interpretation of the joyride. Now, it's easy to say, therefore change your interpretation, but realize that our interpretations are also products of our childhood and our cultural indoctrination, what our parents told us, what religion tells us, what belief in dogma and ideology of our society tells us. So even though we say change it, it's not like you can do it instantly. But one thing you can do is begin to have the insight that it's interactions. One thing I tell some patients of mine is look around you and look at the universe as if it was 360 degrees of mirrors. So every situation in the environment is me interacting with myself and experiencing it as this situation, this person, this thing. So everything, I'm looking at the 360 degrees of mirrors where I'm seeing myself expressing as all this diversity. And now I say, if this is not a pleasant message that I'm getting, then what am I doing that I should change? It's not wrong. It's just, you know, there's no right and wrong. Let's get that straight. There's no right and wrong. There's no evil and there's good. It's just not so pleasant, that's all. And I prefer to the pleasant to the unpleasant. I choose my behaviors in such a way that I amplify the signal of comfort. Three things that I tell my patients sometimes if they have serious illness. Three simple things to do. One, meditate regularly, every day. It gives you access to the gap and the silence. Two, for a while, just be silent. We take a patient and put him in 2 weeks, 3 weeks of silence. Maharshi went into silence for 13 years in a cave. We don't have to do that. Don't worry.
And did you say 13 years?
13 years, he was in silence. And his teacher, Gurudev, was in silence for 40 years in the forest. When they finally went to get him, in the, you know, because they had... The president of India wanted to honor him for something, and he was the next in line for a certain post, spiritual post. Even spiritual people have politics, and he was in the line for that. And they went to get him in the forest. He'd been in silence for 40 years, and they said the tigers would come by and sit next to him, and snakes had wrapped themselves around his legs, and birds would light on his hand, and somebody said, you know, Gurudev, all these snakes, poisonous snakes and cobras around you. He said, what do you mean cobras and poisonous snakes? All I see is God. He could just experience that, and therefore, when he was so firmly established in nonviolence, the Vedic Sutra, when we are firmly established in nonviolence, then all beings around us cease to feel hostility. They become incapable of experiencing it in our presence. And he was so he was 40 years in silence. Well, I tell my patients, let's do 2 weeks. And if you can't do 2 weeks, let's do 1 week. And if you can't do 1 week, let's do 1 day at a time. Just wear a little button over here, I'm in silence. And when people go into silence, the mind becomes very turbulent in the beginning. Because all these things you need to say. One fellow came to me and he said, if I don't call my girlfriend and wish her happy birthday, I'll die. So I said, well, make that call and then we'll go into silence. that's the second thing, meditation, going into silence. And third, very important, get away from the need to define or label or describe or interpret or analyze or evaluate. In other words, relinquish the need to judge. When you stop judging, everything falls into place.
Mm. That's good advice. It really is. I remember in reading Return of the Rishi, was that your first? That was the first?
Second.
You talked about being a little boy in a village in India, and this guy came through, and they buried him. I think the name of the chapter is Today We Buried a Saint. Tell him, I mean, that just fascinates me, that a human being can train themselves to do this. I love this. This is in your book. Don't tell me this is a secret. Yeah. This guy's got more secrets. He said, I'm going to tell you something, but you can't tell anyone. And before you, then he's on Geraldo talking about it.
My mother is very fond of visiting spiritual people, and my mother is an extremely spiritual person. In fact, A few years ago, she went to a cave in the Himalayas, and the legend is that if God wants to manifest himself in that cave, then Shiva manifests as a rearing cobra about 6 inches in front of you with its fangs open. And any other person would be petrified of that experience. When she went into that cave, she meditated there for a few hours, and then this cobra appeared and came down, this big Shiva lingam, slithered down, came right to where she was and stood right 6 inches in front of her like this with its fangs open. And she had tears in her eyes because she knew that she had manifested God.
Wow.
And then, of course, the cobra slithered away. But we had a neighbor who was a Swami, and every few seasons, he would go into samadhi, the experience of silence, go into meditation, close his eyes, and then he would be in that for a week, 10 days, 2 weeks, sitting in one place. And his metabolic rate would slow down to zero. Because when thought comes to a standstill and you're in that gap, then everything comes to a standstill. Time comes to a standstill. No thinking, and yet an awareness. But I wasn't sophisticated enough to understand that. I was a medical student. I went to him, I said, Swamiji, when you don't have a heartbeat and your oxygen consumption is zero and your basal metabolic rate is zero, then that's death. He said, no, my son, that's the experience of immortality. Because it's not an extinction, it's an alive awareness in which all time, all knowledge coexists in a continuum, this past, present, future. It's a huge screen of consciousness. And the Vedic expression is, when I'm grounded in this screen of consciousness, then I notice that infinite worlds come and go on the vast expanse of my consciousness, like motes of dust in a beam of light that's shining through the roof. And then I realized that this is just another little event in space-time. Which doesn't mean that I lose my interest in this, or I don't enjoy it anymore. In fact, I enjoy it much more, because behind me there is the security that when this is over, it's not the end. It's just Act 5, Scene 5 of this particular drama. And when I'm not so involved in the drama that I forget who I am, that I'm the actor and not the character that's in the play, then the one thing that happens is that the hysteria goes. You lose the hysteria. And that is enough. As long as life ceases to be hysterical, that's the beginning, you know, because most people's lives are so hysterical. It's just one hysterical scene followed by another. Mm.
Marianne Williamson, in her new book, Return to Love, which is really wonderful, I think, has a great quote in there. She said that there's purpose to all of this, and God's plan works, and yours doesn't. So get yourself in tune with God's plan. But tell them about how they buried that saint in your village. I want them to tell you that. that just blew me away.
I was a third-year medical student, and we had this saint who came from the Himalayas, and we persuaded him that we would be able to experiment with him. And we put him in a coffin, and we dug a hole 6 feet into the ground and put him there and covered the ground with dust. And 6 days later, we dug him out. And as we opened the coffin, very slowly you start seeing, he was hooked on to EEGs and heart EKGs and so on. And during this period, there was absolutely no electrical activity of his heart. And after 6 days, when he came out, his heart started to flicker just a bit, and then he slowly opened his eyes. He said, could I have a glass of milk, please? After 6 days. He went into the transcendental state of consciousness and maintained it there for 6 days. And see, aging occurs not in the gap, but in the space-time events. Aging occurs in these space-time events. In the gap is where time is manufactured. Time is manufactured in the gap here. So I'll give you an example of how we manufacture time. I read this case report from Germany recently where 7 miners were trapped in a mine. And all of them had a watch except for one person. Wow. And he didn't want the others to get scared. In order to allay their anxieties, every time 2 hours went by, he would call out 1 hour. At the end of the week, they were rescued and all of them were alive except for the one who was calling out the time. He had them change their collective agreement as to what constituted time. It's an agreement. And then they aged accordingly, and he couldn't fool himself because he had a watch. You notice why I don't wear a watch, right? So what...
He's always asking me what time it is, though.
So
now I know why I'm here. I'm the shill here.
So now my physical body, which is made up of quite ordinary carbon and hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen, if you had to buy the raw material from hardware stores, if you had to go to a hardware store and buy the basic ingredients of my body, it could cost you $7. With inflation, maybe $9. So the physical body, the raw material that makes up my body, the carbon and the hydrogen with the recycled earth, water and air, it's been the same for thousands of years. The carbon I have in my bones right now was the same carbon that was in a cluster of nebulas millennia ago, before the Big Bang, etc. It's the same raw material. And carbon and hydrogen and oxygen cannot age. They haven't. A sugar molecule, which is also what makes up my body, or protein molecule, which are basically carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, selenium, tin, whatever, they can't age. Those elements don't age. So why do I? Why do I? Even if the basic raw material that makes up my body doesn't age, why do I age? Because aging is not on the level of matter. Aging is on the gap. See, what's the difference between carbon and hydrogen or oxygen? Anything. One element or another, is just the arrangement of the subatomic particles. Just like in the DNA, which is the code of information, it's not the nucleotides, it's the arrangement, it's the sequence. Right. The sequence is in the gap, which is, this gap is qualitatively different from this gap. By virtue of what? By virtue of just a faint intention, which is freezing that field of infinite possibilities into a certain manifestation. So aging and entropy are a function of how we structure time in the gap. And if we could learn how to, even at a deep level, if we had a different concept of time, as other cultures have. You know, Dr. Alexander Lee from Harvard went to all these other places, like the Hindu Kush Mountains, Soviet Georgia, Abkhazia and all these places in Siberia, different spectrum of aging. 110-year-olds, 115-year-olds riding horses, swimming naked in ice-cold streams. What was different? It wasn't their diet. In fact, if you give Eskimos vegetarian food and fruit and vegetables, they get rotten teeth, hardening of the arteries, and bad tempers. So it's not the diet. It influences us, but it's not that. In these cultures, they had a different concept of what it meant to age and of time. To grow old was to become wiser, to become more respected, to become more loved, to become venerated. If you were old, then you were glamorous. All the young people envied the old. And that translated into a different conception of time, a different processing of time, which is nothing physical, different metabolism of time, different kind of aging. How we conceive time, process it, and metabolize it influences that entropy which is not on the level of matter. And time is a self-interaction generated in the gap. It's generated in the gap. Therefore, if at the deep level our view of time changes, that causes a mutation in our consciousness. That mutation causes a mutation in the mind, which expresses itself as a biological mutation. There are other cultures where they have a view of circular time. They don't think in terms of linear time. They think of all activity as circular. So rest, activity, rest. The earth is spinning and spinning and spinning. What's the difference between yesterday and today and tomorrow? The same earth is just spinning on its own axis. The seasons, they come and go. So spring follows winter, and then there's autumn, and there's winter, and fall, and spring, and it keeps going round and round in a circle. And they view that as circular. And the whole notion of time, it's circular. Completely different physiology as a result of that experience that time is not linear. The New Guinea Islanders, they don't have a word in their vocabulary. They don't have a word in their vocabulary for getting lost. You know, there isn't a word, which means there is no such interpretation. Well, these New Guinea Islanders have never had the experience of getting lost.
Right, so you can...
Because they're in a non-local universe where every place is home.
It's the same with the Native Americans when we tried to buy their land from them.
Exactly, they, Chief Seattle. Yeah, that's, they, you they must had, tell them yeah, about
they
Chief.
Had absolutely no concept in their language for the purchase of land. I mean, how can you own land? You want to give me money for something that you can never own? God owns the land. And sure, we'll take it, but how can it be yours? They just didn't get it. Even reservations, that whole concept, they never talked like that.
By the way, before I forget, people have been asking me all morning and all afternoon, I just want to introduce to you Dr. Reddy, who is a friend of mine, has worked with me for many, many years. Please stand up, Hema. And she's fully trained in Ayurveda. She's running our Ayurvedic clinic here. And everything I say, she can practice it. I can only say it. She can practice it and better. So I just want you to know for her presence. Thank you.
When you say the word Ayurveda, what does that translate to?
The word Ayurveda comes from the two Sanskrit roots, Ayus, which means life, Veda, which means knowledge. So Ayurveda means knowledge of life. And it wasn't gleaned from going and dissecting the universe into bits and fragments. It came from cognition, from that knowingness that you speak of, from just being silent, and then everything is there.
We were talking about using the example of strawberry ice cream, which seems to be both of our favorite flavors. And if you wanted, let's say you wanted strawberry ice cream, you're all here in this room today and you wanted to have some strawberry ice cream, and we're talking about how many ways are there to get strawberry ice cream if you want to get it into your world. I mean, literal potential ways for you to have a dish of strawberry ice cream. And the first way is the way that all of you know. That is, you have a thought. It always, as Emerson said, the ancestor to every action is a thought. Right? You have this somehow, the thought, and then there's the thinker of the thought. So the thought is, like, I just wanted some water, I'd like to have some strawberry ice cream. And then you get in your car and you drive over to Haagen-Dazs, or you get on your bicycle, you go for a walk, and you get yourself some strawberry ice cream. So you act upon that thought. Now, that's the lowest level of higher consciousness. I mean, there's not a vegetable plant that knows how to do that. No stone will ever do that. An animal won't do that. But you know how to do that. So that's higher consciousness, but it's still the lower level. And there's there are many higher levels than that, or there are three. The three beyond that we're talking about. Another way, if you want to have strawberry ice cream, is to have a thought, gee, I'd like to have some strawberry ice cream. And a higher consciousness way is to say to one of your kids, go get me some strawberry ice cream. So that you have the thought and somebody else is acting on it, which is really terrific. It was outlawed, it's called slavery, but it's still a way of getting strawberry ice cream into your life. But the next way, I think, is the more interesting way.
Well, then the next way is that you have the thought, and your friend goes by and he says, hey, Deepak, would you like some strawberry ice cream? I just went to the grocery store and I got some. And then there's a better way. You have the thought and you open the refrigerator, it's there. There's a better way. You have the thought and you turn around and it's there. And then there's an even better way. You have the thought and you manifest it right before your eyes. And it all is a function of how local and non-local you can be at the same time. See, if your attention is always on the relative, then it's the relative is the field of change. Then all you see is change, change, change. Mm. If your attention is on the absolute, then it's non-change. The absolute is the ground of all change. And that is fine, it's great, because it gives you the experience of immortality, but it could get boring after a while. And I said, hey, you know, forever and ever, non-change.
Yeah.
When you have it simultaneously on the relative and the absolute, that in that every experience is experienced in terms of its boundaries, but at the same time in terms of its unboundedness, then you've got it.
Now, this is something that I've experienced in my life a lot more lately that I've been able to go to this level. This is difficult for him to handle here. But, and what I suggest is that when you get to this place that we're alluding to here, which is not a place, that these kinds of events of people walking by and saying, is this your strawberry ice cream? And you say, wow, I was just thinking about that. Ooh, what's going on? How did that happen? Where did that come from? Or you're thinking about your sister and you're just having a conversation with her. You haven't seen her in 5 years and you go to the phone and she's calling, or, you know, the endless numbers of these kinds of synchronistic events that almost like you have a collaboration with fate. They become more frequent, they become more noticeable, they aren't something that you say, oh, how could this happen, isn't that interesting, or it's just chaos, because there's no such thing as chaos,
no.
Is there?
It's chaos. Only the appearance of chaos. There is nothing in chaos. It's like when you go to, say, let's say you go to New York City, and the best example I can use of chaos is Grand Central Station, okay?
Yeah.
So everybody is going hither and thither every which way and what, and you think it's chaotic. But each person is going to a specific destination.
Mm.
And not only that, if you were to announce a track change from track 11 to track 10, you'd see a further intensification of the chaos.
Mm.
But in fact, it is an elaboration of the underlying order.
Mm.
So in all this seeming chaos, there's an underlying order. And it's not only that you should go and get flowers wherever you go.
Mm.
The Vedic expression is, when you're in that state, then wherever you go, flowers will bloom.
Mm. Yeah.
You don't have to wait for them. You choose where you want to go, and the flowers will bloom on your path.
Yeah, I believe that. I mean, I know that. I do. And I've seen it happen, and I believe you can take this kind of consciousness and make it work not only for you but for those around you or for the world, that the thoughts, the images, the vision, the ability to manifest, to create what you want for yourself. You see, if enough of us in the world believe, for example, in a nuclear holocaust, just taking it to something that affects all of us and certainly all of our children who are going to inherit this place from it. If enough of us believe that exists, doesn't it? I mean, that's a consciousness. And if enough of us believe it, we will collectively begin to act upon that consciousness, that fear, if you will. Because fear is really, there's like fear and love in there. You know, I mean, fear is, hate isn't the opposite of love. Fear is the opposite of love. When you eradicate the fear, like if I'm afraid of something happening, so an opinion that somebody might have of me, somebody doing something to me that might not, somebody taking my money away from me, somebody, an IRS audit, whatever it may be that is fearful, I'm creating those pheromones that you were talking about, those fearful pheromones. I like that. That could be a rock group. You know. The fearful pheromones. Watch. They'll be on TV tomorrow. You create that. When I have that fearful thought, I find myself, I use a technique that I'm writing about in Real Magic where I just say, I use the word next. Just like, okay, here's that thought, and I say to myself, next. Like that thought, I don't need that fearful thought, or that fearful thought is going to create the very thing that it is that I'm anticipating. So I just remind myself of next. And the stress inside, the anxiety, whatever, seems to dissipate, and I substitute fear with love. with harmony, with bliss, with ease, with whatever you want to call that. And the minute that I do that, the minute that I just shift that thought, my physiology changes. I am creating molecules with my mind that create love and harmony instead of fear, and the problem is gone.
So this quantum mechanical body that I've been speaking about is nothing new. The ancients called it the subtle body and the causal body. It's that which survives your physical death. When two people are talking on the phone, you come up and cut the lines off. What happens to the people? Nothing happens. They're still there. Certain lines of communication have been disrupted for the time being. Or if we were to destroy the walls, which we would never do it, but let's say this, an earthquake came and destroyed the walls and the roof, what would happen to the space? Nothing. And this is the room, is the space that we're in. Likewise, when the physical body dies, nothing happens to you because you don't live in the physical body. The body lives in you. And the body is that chit akash, that subtle body. Chit in Sanskrit means full of thinking non-stuff. Akash means space, emptiness. Mm-hmm. And when speaking of this body, the rishis say, fire cannot burn it, water cannot wet it, wind cannot dry it, weapons cannot cleave it, it's ancient, it's unborn, it never dies. And yet, even though it's made up of non-stuff, and thinking non-stuff, it has in it all the seeds of every manifestation. When you close your eyes and you see an image flash through the screen of your consciousness, let's say you close your eyes right now and see your mother there, or somebody else, your child, or your sweetheart, or whatever. As soon as you see that image, where is that image? Or when you hear a thought, where is that thought? Or you touch and feel the texture of a rose in consciousness, or the taste of strawberry ice cream. Where is it? It's not in the material world. It's in Chitakash. It's in that quantum mechanical body. And that is the seed for manifestation. That seed, in its most primordial state, is nothing but a desire. And desire is pure potentiality seeking manifestation. It is the mechanics of creation. And both desire and memory are exactly the same. Desire leads to new memories, and new memories create more desires, etc., etc. So again, the spiritual admonition frequently, lose your desires, is a complete misunderstanding of reality. Without desire, there is no manifestation. Desire is the process. Pure being desiring to itself, may I become the mountains, became the mountains. Pure being desiring to itself, may I become the galaxies, became the galaxies. So it's not that we relinquish our desires. That would be very harmful. In fact, in Ayurveda, they say one of the reasons people get ill is they're unable to manifest their desires. And the secret of perfect health is the spontaneous fulfillment of every desire that you've ever had. And the easier the desire is to fulfill, the healthier you will be. So one never curbs one's desires. One just finds a better means of manifesting them. And the principle is not through hard work. Hard work can create a lot of stress. And it's part of this ethic that we've inherited, at least in this part of the world, right, that the harder you work, the better it will be. Well, where do you see that principle in nature? Does nature work hard? Does it have to really work hard to go around the sun every day, or for the birds to migrate, or the fish to go back to their spawning ground? It's all happening with the principle of do less and accomplish more. And ultimately, do nothing and accomplish everything. Then you're there.
There's a wonderful story you tell of the rishis who, a student goes to the rishi and said, I would like to know how long it will take me to... I'm very anxious and I want to learn enlightenment. And the rishi said, if you study with me for 10 years, you'll be there. He said, well, I want to work extra hard. He said, I will work at night, I will work in the day, I will study, I will do everything that I have to can. And the rishi said, 20 years. Deepak, I know that there's no such thing as time, but American Airlines is not at the same level that we are.
There's a quote from Eliot that I think summarizes this in a sense, that mm-hmm. really there's nothing to do. After all this, the final message is, there's nothing to do, because as Wayne says, I'm quoting him again, we're not human doings, we're human beings. And therefore, there's nothing to do. And T.S. Eliot says, we shall not cease from exploration, and the end of our exploring will be to arrive where we started from and know the place for the first time. Mm. Thank you.
Thank you, Deepak. My favorite poet is Robert Frost, and he said similar message for all of us. And it's like, what I want to say in closing is, if you got what you got out of today is valuable, then understand that the thinker behind the thoughts and every thought you have is something to be really aware of, because you're going to manifest in your life exactly what it is that you're thinking. So get real conscious of that. And go to that empty place. Robert Frost said it this way. We all sit around in a ring and suppose, while the secret sits in the center and knows. Thank you, and God bless you.